top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
The basketball team is planning a party. A slumber party to bare their souls.
No, I think your tits are getting bigger.
Mine?
All the girls are coming, except Mary and Linda. And they won't be missed. The party begins at 8 o'clock. It's a slumber party for old time's sake.
Love it too. Do you think I'm getting better?
But be on the lookout for an uninvited guest.
Please send police.
When the pizza arrives, things really start jumping. Some people may have to leave early, but others will hang around and hang around.
You're underage. Negative. Let's go.
You're not gonna eat the dead guy's pizza.
I feel better already. Really, I do.
But for those who stay, there'll be plenty of surprises. Non-stop action. One thing's for sure, no one's getting any sleep the night of The Slumber Party Massacre. Close your eyes for a second and sleep forever.
You're listening to episode 309 of the Really Awful Movies Podcast, The Slumber Party Massacre. This is a bit of a impromptu affair here as I'm recording this one on my phone. And it is a sweltering night in downtown Toronto right here. And I'm out on my balcony trying to keep this one a little bit sotto voce, or a little bit, I guess, under my breath here, so I don't wake up the missus and our young boy, and trying to, organize my thoughts around this film here from 1982, which came out in the peak of the 80s horror boom, and it was followed by a couple sequels, one of which was unheralded, the other became a cult classic, and that came toward, I guess you'd say, the trough of the, the golden era of horror. And this one, I don't know, it has an interesting tone, and people attribute that to it being penned by Rita Mae Brown, whose, feminist beliefs informed the production and the script, but then later her vision became somewhat muted in the finished product as the powers that be, at New World Pictures and Roger Corman, etc., felt that it would be the film's finished product would be better served as a straight ahead horror rather than a kind of a subversive tongue-in-cheek send up of the genre a la Scream. So what you're left with is, a film that doesn't entirely know what it wants and has its foot in both camps. So here, forgive me if I'm trespassing a little bit on what the segment that I typically use to close the show, which is What Did I Learn? So apologies right off the bat for that one, but it's definitely a a film that doesn't know in which direction it's going, and I'm reminded of that famous quote attributed to the Roman senator Seneca, if you don't know to which port one is sailing, and no wind is favorable. Anyway, the beginning of this film and throughout, it stands apart, I guess, from its early 80s brethren in that it has almost like a Bach chorale kind of organ music, and that really makes it stand apart, because you have this, I mean, sinister, I guess, pipe organ kind of sound, and then midway through it does revert to the usual, I guess, Casio synth score that everyone came to know and love in that time period. But it's funny nonetheless to hear this very elevated, very highbrow kind of music as the backdrop to what is in effect a silly movie about a guy with a power drill who lays waste to a bunch of co-eds. Perhaps the Bach element came via Beethoven, as the director of this one wrote, I think, Beethoven, not obviously the movie about the Bonn-born composer, but the Shaggy Dog. And it's not a Shaggy Dog tale of a movie, but, and that would be Amy Holden Jones, who has a pretty good directorial touch here. Anyway, I gotta say that when it comes to moving parts, I mean, you can't go wrong with a killer who uses a drill, and you could call him a driller killer if there wasn't already a movie by Abel Ferrara of the same name. But this one, I guess the killer uses this as his tool of choice, and the killer is rather unremarkable sort, who's kind of a combination of TV personality Andy Cohen mixed with John Travolta, who wears denim, and he really cuts a rather unremarkable figure, and his MO is not really explained, although he's just some sort of misogynist creeper, so as was the case in a lot of these stalk and slash kind of movies from the period. But when you have moving parts, that always is a good is always good fodder for horror. I'm thinking back to this horrible summer job I had, which nonetheless helped me pay my way through University of Toronto, but it was a furniture, I guess, factory, and my job was to stand at the end of a conveyor belt with a dolly and wait for glued cupboards to come down the belt, pick them up, put them on the dolly, and once I'd stacked enough of them to take them to a truck and have them delivered somewhere. So yeah, riveting stuff here. In fact, it was so dull that I would actually count off the time in my head and go really slowly so as to make sure that I would lag the actual time considerably, so I could count off my breaks and stuff. What I do remember once that as my head was in the clouds and I was thinking of obviously anything but the assembly line drudgery, that I almost got my hand caught in this contraption and it took off part of my nail, and it was terrifying. And needless to say, moving parts and particularly drills are just terrifying. And I'm thinking of my almost namesake Giovanni Lombardo Radice, the Italian actor who's been variously flayed and you know, when had his innards taken out and his peen lopped off to varying degrees. He's been abused throughout all these horror films, but particularly there's a scene in City of the Living Dead, the exemplary Lucio Fulci production, in which Mr. Lombardo Radice gets a drill, and this time this would be a stationary one, not a one that you can, that's battery powered, that the killer in this movie uses, but he gets a power drill, I guess, drilled through his temple to quite spectacular effect. Now, this movie is not called Driller Killer, and it's called The Slumber Party Massacre for a reason. Now, the backdrop of this one is has something more in common with the likes of Graduation Day and that kind of, or maybe even The Last Shark. I believe that one used some kind of sailboat race as the backdrop, and Graduation Day used a bunch of Olympic sports and athletes and co-eds and varsity athletes. This one focuses on basketball players at this local, what seems to be a college, and I'm guessing, because it was sometimes tough to distinguish whether they were college co-eds or simple high school. It seemed like, I mean, one of them admitted to being 18, so I'm going to guess that it's a college thing. Regardless, with the amount of traveling you see on the hard court, you might as well amass a bunch of frequent flyer points, because this is absolutely ridiculous. There's some pretty horrendous round ball action taking place. And anyway, go Raptors as you try and defend your title. But I got a huge kick out of the various women at this college, let's call it a college, trying to be the Harlem Globetrotters and ending up much rather like the Washington Generals. So anyway, as they're walking around campus, there's a creeper who's in the back of a van, and he's, scoping them out, and he's got his hardware in tow. And that is, of course, a power drill that's battery-operated and portable and has a rather long bit. But again, it's not the size of your drill bit, but it's, how you use it. And he uses it with sublime effectiveness here. And so essentially, but I mean, this is not for nothing that it's called Slumber Party Massacre, and this is an occasion around which all these women gather. And it should be said that director Amy Holden Jones is having a lot of fun with the tropes and the cliches and stupidity that the genre is known for, particularly as it pertains to the female form. And her camera lingers on the back of one of the team members as she's showering in this rather protracted and silly gym shower scene, where the entire team has this communal shower and passes the soap to one another, and it's almost got Pam Grier kind of women in prison softcore vibe to it. And it's it's quite sexy. And in the first 5 minutes, one of the principals doffs her top very quickly. So obviously this was a favorite of mine when I was, trying to score R-rated movies from the local Korean corner store growing up in Toronto, and bemoaning the fact that the local Blockbuster did not have all the movies with massacre in the title that I wanted to as a completist rent. So that would include, Sorority House Massacre and Hospital Massacre, to name just a few. And these titles have come up on the podcast with Jeff and I as films that have been, wildly influential in our formative years. Anyway, you have in this film like gangbusters opener and ending, and then in the middle a lot of just dead weight, frankly, and a lot of multiple jump scares that do no one any favors, particularly two of which involving a cat, although one of which is quite impactful with one of the, I guess it's a building superintendent or some sort of handy woman, I guess in this case, who is drilling a hole through the door of the basketball coach, and you're prompted to believe that this is actually the killer, but the camera pans away and no, it's actually someone getting some work done on their apartment or office, I forget which, but it was quite funny and quite arresting. And there's a couple of interesting kills that are shown from the backside of the killer, and this very phallic spinning drill bit protruding below his junk, and that I think became the poster as well. Now, the sequel, a lot of people find a hell of a lot more fun, where instead of a power drill, the director substituted an electric guitar with a drill affixed to the end, and the killer was almost Grease-like in that it was atypical for the period, which would have been the 80s, but he had a Gene Vincent, Bebop Aluba, kind of 60s, 50s doo-wop greaser kind of aesthetic in it. Maybe in the 80s, appetite for all things 50s and 60s was in full gear with the likes of Happy Days and The Fonz and, of course, the aforementioned Grease. So a lot of horror heads and gore hounds actually hold the sequel to Slumber Party Massacre in higher regard. And it is admittedly very fun because the corny antagonist has a lot of songs. And he sings, one of them has a chorus that goes buzz, 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 as he splays his victims with his unorthodox axe and rocks out in a leather jacket. So at least kudos to them in the sequel for giving the antagonist a lot more personality than this one. And this one, he's very, very milquetoast and very nondescript. Now, as was par for the course in these movies, you have these, you know, couple of horn dogs who are into these women who are having their slumber party, and they're trying to gain access to this, you know, tremendous event. And as well they should. I mean, the women are like doffing their clothes, like it's just like nobody's business. It's really quite ridiculous how quickly they strip down to their skivvies and then to the totally all together. I mean, this is the kind of thing that men fantasize that women do at slumber parties, but which likely, well, never say never, but probably doesn't happen or wouldn't be the kind of thing you'd be invited to anyway. So you have this almost Animal House horn dog subplot going on with these rather forgettable bouffant-haired, goofy 80s stereotypes running around campus. So certainly not big men on campus, but and nonetheless, as is the stalk and slashes MO, a bunch of basically vics in there to speak a few words and then meet their maker. So hard to say whether this one slots in. I would say it's a little bit underrated, frankly, at least with the opener and some of the humor that's injected into this, but also, and particularly, there's a Play Girl cover featuring Sly Stallone, one of our favorites here on the podcast, that being Stallone, not, the magazine, but it's pretty funny. There's also a younger sibling, a sister, who's dressed almost like a Hooters waitress with the orange shorts and a white top, and who's being counseled by her older sibling about how she's, you know, really indeed beautiful, and she's an ugly duckling who's going to morph into a, you know, a pulchritudinous swan later on. So whether that would happen, I guess you'll have to find out, because I'm not going to spoil that one, but you can find out for yourself if she or any of the principals survive. Now, I'm going to cut this one a little bit tight here, and I think on account of just, again, the heat, it's like 32 degrees inexplicably, which in Fahrenheit I believe is 90 degrees, and we're finally reaching that point in the summer where the lows are low enough to sleep comfortably enough if your AC unit isn't powerful enough to do the job. And I've got a window rattler here for a high-rise apartment building, and it barely covers things. So in terms of what did I learn, let's see here. Well, Rita Mae Brown, you know, feminist author, injects a lot of funny, sly lines into the proceedings. Wish I could call one to memory, but hey, it's getting late, and you know, I had a long day at work tracking all things grocery as a business reporter. So anyway, I also learned that there is a really like effective filmmaking, especially in the horror space, involves knowing when and how, and particularly not to use music. And there's a protracted scene where the killer is roaming around the gym of this college / high school, whatever it is, and very much akin to the scene in Graduation Day in the lockers, where he's actually hunting one of the victims, and the victim's resourcefully reaches for a towel after she gets injured so she can attend to her wounds. While the killer skulks around in the dark and again tries to, finish what he started with this drill. Now, I don't even know how I would contextualize this film. Like, do I compare it to other films featuring a power drill wielding antagonist, or is this the kind of thing that's a more of a silly romp, more sexcapades, mutilator type movie or Fall Break, as it's also known, that kind of movie with fun and frolicking and frivolity. I think it firmly falls in the latter camp, and to some extent it's kind of a success. I mean, there's undeniable charming little bits and weird vignettes. The killer at one point counts his victims when they're in the trunk of a car, and it kind of adds a little bit of realism to a genre that tends not to have the antagonist do a hell of a lot. But he seems well enough self-aware as to what he's up to, and the victims, to their credit, also bandy together, and instead of separating and for easy pluckings like Friday the 13th series, they really do join forces and grab whatever weaponry at hand to be able to at least attempt to stave off their attacker once he gets going with them. So kudos to them, and kudos to this one. At least it's fun, mindless, and escapism, and really, you know, what more could you ask for on a sweltering summer night? I mean, the film's runtime is all of 76 minutes. This has to be the shortest horror I can recall. I mean, it's just tight, yet again, and it's kind of quibbling to say that there's a bunch of silly jump scares in the middle, and they did get a little bit too numerous, but I mean, you know, to their credit, they developed the characters sufficiently, and there's enough of them in whom one can invest. I believe, I forget who played Trish, but it's the lead character who acquits herself quite well as she's being, you know, he's under a full-on assault by this denim-clad bozo here. Anyway, I'm going to give this one a solid 3 out of 5. And it's funny, when the horror genre is so expansive and so rich and so diverse, that earlier today I was watching Patrick, a Australian film about a telepathic kind of killer that's in a similar vein to the Cronenberg classic Scanners, where Louis Del Grande infamously has his head explode, you know, with some spectacular special effects. But I went from that to my first viewing, and I was to podcast it, but I couldn't get myself in the right frame of mind, but Ringu, the Japanese, you know, quintessential Japanese J-horror from the 90s that was subsequently remade with Naomi Watts, and which I hadn't seen because I tend to want to track down the original source material before I check out a remake, which undoubtedly will, but I'm not sure, disappoint. Anyway, it's just, you know, it's such a, you know, a verdant, like, just blossoming full genre, full of all sorts of different types of films to satiate you. It's just remarkable, and it's easy to dismiss films like The Slumber Party Massacre as just stalk and slash TNA garbage, but really the horror genre is so much more than this. But even this stuff is really good. It's like comfort food. This is like a bucket of KFC for gorehounds. It's fun as hell, and I hope you continue to listen to the podcast, the Really Awful Movies podcast, and check out our horror tome about all things weapons, Death by Umbrella, the 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons, with a foreword by our buddy Lloyd Kaufman from Troma. Urge you to check that out and support the show. Check out that, because we don't have Patreon. We just really like love horror, and hope you do too, and pick up that book. So anyway, I shall talk to you soon, and take care, everyone. Thank you.